first, let's head west to the Utah wilderness, where ecologist and writer Terry Tempest Williams has been writing about sense of place for years. In her most recent book called Finding Beauty in a Broken World, Williams explores sense of place through visits to three very different locations: the workshops of mosaic artists in Italy, a village for genocide survivors in Rwanda, and a wild prairie dog town in Utah. She told Steve Paulson it all began with a prairie dog biologist and the story of the prairie dog's language.
There's a remarkable biologist named Khan Slobodchikov, and he has spent his lifetime studying the vocalizations of prairie dogs. What he has determined is that prairie dogs, with their systems of chirps, alert calls, alarm calls, can define, describe man with gun, man with gun who was here yesterday, man without gun, man with dog, man without dog, woman with red shirt, woman with green
That's
shirt.
That's incredible. I mean, it's not only incredible that they can do all this, but that he could figure this out.
It's incredible. He really has dissected, deconstructed these sound bites, if you will, in radio language, and he's come up with over 100 words of vocabulary, a prairie dog vocabulary, and has found that they have a grammar all their own. When I asked him why he's doing this and what we can learn from this, in his own words, he says, "I'm hoping that this work will help show that prairie dogs and all animals are not just mindless robots that can be disposed of as vermin or property, but sentient beings that should be treated with empathy and respect."
Now, you spent a couple of weeks in a 10-foot-tall tower watching these prairie dogs. What was the most memorable part of that experience?
Two things. One, how I was an addict to speed. You know, I've been watching prairie dogs all my life, but this was an intense 2-week period in Bryce Canyon National Park with a phenomenal biologist named John Hoagland, who spent his lifetime studying prairie dogs. The first 3 days up in this tower, I thought I was going to go mad. And I thought, there is nothing happening here. And my task, Steve, was to create 5-minute intervals, observations. It was like I was in a rehab center with no place to get out. On the fourth day, I thought, what's happened? I cannot write fast enough to record everything I'm seeing. It wasn't the prairie dogs who had changed. It was my own soul had quieted down to the point where I could suddenly see again. We move so quickly. We're in this distracted, fragmented, fractured world. We don't even recognize wholeness when we're standing in the middle of it. I think the other thing that stunned me was that every morning and every night, Steve, the prairie dogs emerge from their home burrow. They would stand, they would face the rising sun, and I promise you, they would press their palms together and stand, almost in the gesture of a sun salutation, for 20, 30 minutes.
Really? Wow.
And then they would go on about their day. Huh. Again at night, they would return to their home burrow, press their palms together, face the setting sun, and stand in stillness.
That's astonishing.
Day after day after day, and one could imagine clear back to the Pleistocene. What do they know that we have forgotten?
Now, partly what you're doing here, and this is really what you've been doing for your whole career as a writer, is you're talking about a sense of place. You know, in this case, sort of this particular habitat where the prairie dogs exist, and you're coming to appreciate it. And I guess I'm wondering what that means to you. What does sense of place mean to you?
You know, it's such a profound question, and it's a question that I have given my life to, and I don't know the answer. You know, I mean, it keeps changing. For me, what a sense of place means is I know where I belong. You know, I belong in the interior west. I belong in a landscape of long, wide horizons and red rock canyons that rise upward like praying hands. But it also means to me being present, paying attention, learning the names of things. A sense of place, I think, evolves to an ethic of place. How do we behave? How do we define our notion of community? And can we extend our notion of community to include all life forms, not just our own species? And I think one of the challenges of this book, one of the critiques of this book could be, how can you dare to talk about the plight of the prairie dog juxtaposed against a genocide, the genocide in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And my response would be that the extermination of a species, the extermination of a people, are predicated on the same impulse. And that would be an impulse of prejudice, cruelty, ignorance, and arrogance. And I think, Steve, until we can create a sense of place, an ethic of place that includes this kind of wholeness, we will be relegated to this fractured, divided, fragmented world.
Well, it sounds like you're also raising a paradox here, which is maybe to really understand sense of place, we need to both have a sense of what is local, sort of in a very specific area, for instance, this prairie dog city in Utah, as well as a global sense. You're going to Rwanda to talk with survivors of genocide. And I mean, the suggestion there is that that story affects us. You know, we have to respond to that. And so there's a whole global aspect to sense of place.
I think that's such a good point. And as you speak, it makes me think about, you know, we averted our gaze in both instances, both in the situation of the prairie dog, you know, when Lewis and Clark came west. Prairie dogs in the prairies and plains, as you know, were 200 miles wide, 100 miles long. You know, they followed the stampeding hooves of bison. Now, in Utah, there are only 9 viable wild Utah prairie dog colonies left. Nobody cares. You look at the Rwandan genocide, 1994, April, May, June, 1 million Tutsis murdered by hand by Hutu extremists. We in America averted our gaze. We did nothing. You know, how we speak about the world is how we see the world. We call prairie dogs vermin. The Hutu extremists called Tutsis cockroaches. Hmm. Expendable.
So what were you doing in Rwanda 10 years or so after the genocide? Why did you go there?
I didn't want to go. And actually, Wendell Ye, a community artist, a mosaicist who understands that creating mosaics is taking that which is broken and creating something whole, she was at a conference in Barcelona. She heard Jean Bosco of the Rwandan Red Cross talk about the genocide. She went up and said 4 words, "How can I help?" He said, "Come to Rwanda and you will know what to do." She went to Rwanda. She went to the Rugerero genocide survivors' village on the edge of the Congo in Rwanda. She listened to the women who were mothers. And what she heard the women say, "The bones of our children have not been buried." And there she saw in their homes the bones of their beloved wrapped in faded swaths of fabric. And the women said, "Help us design, help us build a genocide memorial where our dead can be properly buried and put to rest." Lily came back to America, organized a team. She asked if I would go and be her scribe. I said no. I didn't want to go to a country so familiar with death. And she never took her eyes off me. Hmm. And I said yes. And I think on some level I understood that my humanity depended on it. And it did. It changed everything for me. And I don't mean to be overly dramatic, but I think until you've been to a country where every square inch has been bled on and bled over, we can't really even have an inkling of what it means to be human.
Now, going back to an earlier genocide, the Holocaust, there was a lot of talk back then about whether art could be made after the Holocaust. I mean, could art hope to try to respond to genocide? I'm guessing that's something you must have thought about.
It's such a good point. And what I learned from Lily Ye, who I really think is a holy woman, is that beauty isn't optional, but it is food for our spirit. That art isn't peripheral, but literally a strategy for survival. We saw this in the village, eyes turned inward, especially in the women, when their children were handed cups of paint and a paintbrush and started creating murals on this very drab gray surface. Suddenly the village came alive. You had Cheshire cats, you had cows with 24 udders, you had angels emerging out of sunflowers. And the women came out of the village, the old men came out of their doors, their houses, their hovels, and a spark was born. And you realize beauty is a spark for social change. They've now created a sunflower cooperative where The fields surrounding the genocide village are all ablaze with these golden petals. They harvest the seeds, they put them through this machine, and now they are selling this beautiful golden sunflower oil. Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, 2 weeks ago just went to pay the village a visit. Mm-hmm. Art, the spark for social change.
Terry Tempest Williams talking with Steve Paulson. Her most recent book is called Finding Beauty in a Broken World.